要是在基础上面要小一点。On Venus, there are nothing happening. There are not the beams so much turbulent, so much convection, because it is a very much thinner atmosphere on Mars than on Venus. And you're just not going to have large quantities of gas moving back and forth in a gaseous gas phase. So where on Venus does the oxygen go? We hope we get to find that out, but we're not using the investigation. The Pioneer Venus orbit is going to do a truly remarkable thing.It is only at an orbit around Venus, which is a long ellipse. Elliptical orbit is what the reason we always incorrectly refer to as an egg-shaped orbit, because there are so many more ellipses. An egg has a different curve at the two ends, right? Okay, if you imagine an egg that has the same curve at the two ends, it's not the same, isn't it? It's not the same. All right, I think it's done. They're all same eggs, not different eggs. You have to take care of both ends. That's the case that you get in the other shape of the orbit.The new end of that orbit, the parallel is going to be so close to the atmosphere, the surface of the moon. I don't know how that works. It's literally being flying through against the antenna part of the upper atmosphere of the moon. So it is literally an atmospheric explorer. There's a series of spacecraft that are putting the orbit around the Earth that get as low as possible in the Earth's atmosphere. They're called atmospheric explorers.And there are a bunch of the same scientists on the Pioneer Venus team. There are 117 scientists all together in Pioneer Venus. The biggest number of scientists that have ever landed on a planetary mission, and that's because this is the biggest number of experiments that have ever been flown on a planetary mission. In that respect, Pioneer Venus is the most complex planetary mission that's ever been flown, despite the fact that you don't even want to get to it, so we spread several. In another respect, it's not. Viking actually is. Viking only had 13 experiments, but the other things were tremendously more complicated, particularly biology investigation, than anything from Pioneer Venus. But still, we got the biggest number of experiments on Pioneer Venus of anything that's ever been flown. 12 different experiments to observe the atmosphere from actually in it, as well as from farther out taking pictures of it and doing this kind of spectral observation on the orbiter, basically the correct one. And there's a very simple reason why it might. As you go out through the solar system,And look at what terrestrial planets are made of, one after another. You have 12 of them altogether, some of which are revolving around building planets and moons, but still terrestrial planets. And those are Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Moon, Mars, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto revolving around Jupiter, Titan revolving around Saturn, and Triton revolving around Neptune and Pluto, okay? And you find there's a systematic progression in what they are made of,In that, the difference between a terrestrial planet and a Jovian planet is basically that when a terrestrial planet formed, its gravity was too weak to hold anything that was a gas. At that time, at that particular distance from the Sun, so terrestrial planets are made only of whatever was solid at that time, at that distance from the Sun. And when you get farther out from the Sun, there were things that were solid out there, such as water, which would have been gaseous in where the Earth is. All right?The Sun was much hotter, apparently, when the planets were formed than it is now, several hundred, even several thousand times hotter. It was going through a stage which we know the stars, we think we know, the stars do go through during their very early lifetime, lasts about 100 million years, and the star, in the case of the Sun, settles down for 10 billion years to be a normal star that we have now. At this early stage, where it is very much hotter and brighter than it is,the main sequence stage, the normal one, and now it's called the Centauri phase, named for a star which appears to be doing it right now. It's in the final process of being born at the present time, and there are all several hundred Centauri stars that are no more than each other all the time. Well, the most spectacular effect of that is that Mercury, although everybody always has the Mercury phase, it looks just like the moon, so it's going to be a cover of praise.Lots of worlds are covered with craters, but we know that that's through the moon, you know. The inside of Mercury is radically different from the moon. Almost the entire planet is made of a nickel iron core, which takes up 80% of the volume of Mercury. The whole thing is basically a 3,000-mile ball bearing with a few hundred miles of rock as a shell on the outside. That's what we see in those pictures.Okay, the reason, and see the moon has almost no iron core at all. The Earth has an iron core, but you know, much more normal kind of size is made of about a third of the mass of the Earth. Well, the reason apparently, it was quite awe-inspiring, the sun was so hot when the planets were forming that 36 million miles away, rock was a gas. Until the very end of the million or so year period that Mercury took to accrete, to fall together. And then apparently, up until that time, only metals were solid. In other words, they had the highest boiling points of all, so even though the rocks were, they were not. And so you had just the metals. And then at the very end of this period, you had some rocks managing to accumulate on the outside. All right? Venus is made of rock, and so is the Earth. But you notice that there is more water on Earth than there is on Venus, and yet still very, very much less than there would be if we had all the water that we really had coming to us. If you look at the relative abundances of the different kinds of atoms that make up the universe, the ones that make up water, hydrogen and oxygen, are something like three times as abundant as the ones that make up atomic rock, which are mostly oxygen plus silicon, and other things mixed in with them, and combined with them. And in the outer solar system, the terrestrial planets are made of mostly frozen water. And further out, you get things like frozen methane, frozen ammonia by the time you get to Titan. And so those are the normal ones as far as terrestrial planets go, as far as the composition goes, you see. And then in the inner solar system, you have this admirable situation of virtually all of the water was lost in space because the sun was so hot during the deep Aries stage. And so our water does not outweigh our rock by 2 or 3 times the way it really ought to. All right, so you see it makes sense out of the whole scenario that Venus would have less water than the Earth per cubic mile, and Mars would have more. And some of you believe that Mars does have more per cubic mile. It's all hidden underground, so this is indirect, but there is reason to believe that that Mars got more water per capita. Still mostly rock, but more per cubic mile than the Earth did.
So that all makes sense.
Okay, now, how do you decide between the two theories? The picture that I gave you is suggestive, but that doesn't make it true.
Here's how you decide. If Venus has had a lot of water in the past and has been losing its settling into space, then you take advantage of the fact that oxygen comes in two different forms. Oxygen has some two different isotopes, one of which is heavier than the other.
All right?
The heavy one is going to get lost into space less rapidly than the lighter one. The heavier one is oxygen 18 and the lighter one is oxygen 16. So if Venus is so low in water because it's been losing it, then when you look at the relative abundances of oxygen 18 and oxygen 16 in the Venus atmosphere, with both the Pioneer Venus orbiter and the Mars probe are supposed to do, you will find that there is more oxygen 18 relatively on Venus than there is on Earth. On the other hand, if Venus has never had very much water to begin with, then it was oxygen 5, or water you find is going to have the isotope ratio in the same relative abundance. No, as a matter of fact, it is not a universal law. When you look at the Earth and the Moon and Mars, the isotope ratios are exactly the same. There are meteorites, however, and we don't know where they came from. The problem is, it's really frustrating. Here are two safe rocks being delivered to you by nature. Everybody can go out there and get them. Oh, you don't know where they came from. You know? I mean, you can track their orbit in some cases before they fell. We don't know what their ultimate origin was. But there are a number of different classes of meteorites which have different oxygen isotope ratios in the Earth, and we differ from other oxygen isotope ratios. And that is just some of the evidence. I don't know if you know that there are two classes of kinds of atoms in the universe, hydrogen and helium, and then anything else. Alright? Hydrogen and helium make up 99% of the atoms in the universe. They were formed when the universe itself was first formed. We don't know if they were 15, 20 billion years ago, something like that, what's called the Big Bang. And apparently, the temperature and the pressure were so great then that only the two simplest, most stable kinds of atoms could survive. The only hydrogen and helium were formed. The 1% contamination of heavier stuff, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, silicon, all of the things that terrestrial planets and the atmosphere and iron are made of, were created later inside certain special stars, and these are the heaviest stars, which are the only ones. The stars shine by the energy they get by converting one element to another. Okay, so you also need to react. The pieces are hot, therefore they'll keep the gold. All right? The sun shines because it's very high in the field, and that doesn't feel good for this effect. But these heavy stars get to the point. They do high in the field first, but then they start building heavier elements, starting in the field. And they go really into carbon, and carbon to oxygen, and you get silicon in there, and iron, and then aluminum, and aluminum, and all of these things. And in fact, in very small quantities, you get elements made that are not the major ones, and that's where the rare things like gold and so forth come from. And it is those very stars that do that, which do something at the end of their lives that normal stars, such as our sun, do not do, and that is they explode. The entire star blows itself apart. That is called a supernova. And when it does that, it spews all of these heavy elements that it made out into space, where they contaminate the clouds of gas and dust from which younger generations of stars are forming. And by the time the sun forms, and let's go with it, 4.6 billion years ago, that level of contamination from all the generations of supernovae that preceded us had at least about 1%. And that 1% is what we're trying to make up because our gravity are too weak to hold on to the moon. You are made of material. Every atom of it, besides the hydrogen, has gone through a supernova explosion. You are quite literally made of stardust. That is what the dust, the main material of the planet, is. Alright? There is evidence, and this is just some of it, that there was one last big nearby supernova explosion just before the solar system fell. And you see, if that happened at the very end, just before the solar system formed, you might have gotten a cloud of what that particular star had produced coming in from one side, which might not have mixed with all the rest of the material in the cloud of gas and dust before the solar system elsewhere, but you actually had different substances forming in different places. Isn't it incredible that you had one last big supernova explosion just before the solar system formed? No. We also have conservatory uses, and that's why I told you, the first observational evidence that the clockwork of the gas coming out from the supernova explosion hindered the formation of stars. In exactly the same way as the shockwave of a supersonic plane going through the atmosphere can trigger the condensation of raindrops out of a low-pressure atmosphere. And so, we probably owe not only the atoms that we are made of, but the very existence of the solar system to that last supernova. For the entire story, I mean, not all stars, surely formed because of the creation of the solar system, but that's where they started forming, okay? But, you know, it's been an egg problem here. But once you had all these stars and you had occasion of supernovae, apparently it's a very different mechanism to produce and generate new stars. So that was an awfully long answer to a very good question, but as you see, it was a central important question, and it leads to an awful lot of news and stuff.
Back in the early 50s and late 50s, Cedric Worley published an important book of Aurora in the Hawaiian industry.
Mm-hmm. He met the Adam White.
We were just talking about the book before, about what do they know about Venus before.
Venus does not have a magnetic field of any significant size. There is a magnetometer in the Pioneer Venus orbiter, and if there is a very small magnetic field, or perhaps local fields down on the surface, we'll find them. But there is nothing like the field of the Earth. Oh, I see what you mean. You increase the chance of aurora. You can't get solar particles around on the night side. Okay? They just hit the day side and go around, and it'll get absorbed. In fact, that's a very interesting thing about the atmosphere of Venus. The solar wind, the thin stream of particles that come out from the sun, never interacts with the atmosphere of the Earth. It is deflected around our planet by the magnetic field of the Earth.
And so there was a figure. On Venus, the solar wind actually hit the upper atmosphere. And one of the major areas of finding the Venus orbit to study is what effect does that have on the atmosphere and on solar wind? There is a sort of pseudo-magnetic field effect. I mean, it's not a magnetic field, but it has the same effect on the solar wind as a magnetic field on the Earth does. And that is, Venus does have an ionosphere. Okay, there is a layer of electrically charged atoms in the upper atmosphere. And the reason for that layer is that in the upper atmosphere, X-rays from the sun are able to penetrate. They can't get very far through the gas. Any gas of any thickness at all will stop X-rays of any wavelength. And in fact, in the near-surface atmosphere, no X-ray wavelength will go more than 2 inches. So much for Superman is up here, it would be completely worthless on the planet in atmosphere. So we can reduce them into the crystal and atmosphere. Anyway, it was very strange to put on the gas, but then there was a question that was being done. It's funny, it's exactly the same word, except on what comes from the same way we use it. The ionosphere has an electric charge. Because the atoms, what happens is the X-rays knock electrons off the atoms. So what's left is atoms, all right? And the electric charges of those atoms repel the electric charges of the solar wind. The solar wind gas is also electric charge. Most of the matter in the universe is not made of whole atoms. The negative atoms that lost one or more electrons by one process or another. There's two major processes and some minor ones. The major ones are you zap it with radiation wave, X-ray, ultraviolet, whatever, depending on the material, or you hit it with something, for example, a proton, electron, whatever. And virtually all of the matter of the universe is made of parts of atoms, not whole ones. We just happen to be, the reason we're in school that all matter is made of atoms, and the very first building this is what's looking at. We just happen to be in one of the very local settings. The surface of a planet like this is going to be mostly made of full atoms, although if every atom, if every ion in your body is suddenly required to start again, you die. Chemical processes require on the occasion also. But that's my whole story.
The electric field of the ionosphere of Venus repels the solar wind, but not until the solar wind has gotten down almost to the ionosphere itself. It's not a terribly strong process. So you actually have solar wind pouring the upper atmosphere of Venus, basically on the daytime. On the night side, you're going to have a cavity in the solar wind. And that's not theory. That cavity was flown through by 9-10. 9-10 had a magnetometer on it. We didn't know Mercury had that magnetometer. We already knew Venus. But it made observations of the planetary magnetic field, the solar wind magnetic field, and worked through. And that's happening here, no question about it. They never had aurora. Aurora is charged particles, whatever their origin, being clustered around and hitting the upper atmosphere on the night side and causing the atoms to blow, rather than molecules to blow. So whatever it is, acting like it is not of aurora origin. The Soviet astrophysicist Nikolai Kozyrev claimed in the early 60s, if I remember correctly, to have many spectroscopic observations of the action light and to have seen auroral lines. He got to have been wrong. And certainly, he was doing something when he sent the spacecraft up there, you know, and did not see any auroral lines in the night sky when he looked for the spectacle. We didn't know that we had a magnetic field, and there was a reason to assume that it didn't. All the theory was that it was certain. And the theory was certain too small. All the other small bodies didn't have a magnetic field, and that's because you need a molten core. You do not need an iron core for a magnetic field. You can get it from rock, but you need a molten core. The Earth is not a permanent magnet. It isn't a big ball of solid iron down there with a magnet that is a giant bar magnet. It's molten, and you need a permanent magnet up above a temperature around 800 degrees, which is called the 34, and it loses magnetism.
You know, so here is an electromagnet. What you need is a molten core so that, again, the atoms are partially ionized, and convection, which moves some of that stuff around, can be systematically. It has to be on a slight tendency to go systematic motion. But if you have any amount of charge moving more than one direction than the other, that's going to create an electric current, and an electric current generates a magnet, and that's what we get to look at during the magnetic field of the Earth, for example. So we can. There's not a lot we don't understand about the origin of the magnetic field of the Earth. How does the magnetic field split every 100,000 years or so, for example? But, you know, precisely that giant bulb that you're going to take to the stage. Well, to get that, then first of all, you're finding that it's big enough. So you're going to pull in more, typically small parts, right? They're effectively hotter than the sun. And you need to find that it's big enough to have a molten core, and so you're going to move, it doesn't have a magnetic field, you're not surprised, it's small bodies. You've got Mars, it doesn't have a magnetic field, you're not surprised, it's small bodies. Mercury is also a small body, alright? So you set for that reason. You also need a location that is rapid enough to excite the motion given the core. So it's possible to rotate itself. And Mercury, as we use rotation very slowly, does not have a magnetic field. You know, the big of the Earth is very large, and more than the world, we don't know. We probably won't find that in some of the geniuses that change the chemistry indirectly by observations of what the interior structure of Venus does to the orbit, of the orbit. But Venus does rotate slowly because the right side doesn't have a molten core, and Mercury rotates slowly also. Yeah, the Mercury is just obviously a candidate for a body to predict. It couldn't have a magnetic field. And there were a lot of people who criticized Cushing having found it on Mary's head just for that reason. They said, you know, it's the roots of the later rock, or even some other instrument. But in the end, anyway, the first part of it was to study the airplane having a magnetic field. So it went that close to the sun, but they hadn't gone that close to the sun before. And everybody was astonished. Mercury has a magnetic field. It's weak. It's only a 1% as strong as the Earth. But, you know, what did that say about $1,000? The market was not just $20, it's not at all. It's not supposed to be there. It's a kind of weird magnetic field. If you draw the dipole, that is the line from North Magnetic Pole to the planet to the South Magnetic Pole, you expect to go to the center of the planet. Well, the Earth doesn't exactly, you know, talk about a little bit, but not very much. And you're expected to be very much closer to the rotation axis. Mercury's dipole is offset from the planet from the center by the entire half of the radius of the planet. Which means that there are 10 to 1 variations in terms of the magnetic field because of the Mercury. So there are places where the solar wind is fended off tremendously in the United States by the magnetic field, and there are other places where the magnetic field is so weak, solar wind is so weak in the solar wind. And so this is sort of very easy to look at the magnetic field. And people, on that note, we're going to have to end because we are here and in time with number 30. So thank you very much for your interest, and remember, much more than this next time. And you went to the fact that you did the carbon dioxide again. On Venus, that ought not to happen. There ought not to be so much turbulence, so much convection, because it is a very much thinner atmosphere on Mars than on Venus, and you're not going to have large quantities of gas moving back and forth in the gaseous gas pit. So where on Venus does the oxygen go? You hope it's going to find that everybody is going to get rid of it. The planet Venus orbit is going to do a truly remarkable thing. You're going to have an orbit around Venus, which is a long ellipse. Elliptical orbit is what the Newton will always be incorrectly referred to as an egg-shaped orbit because they're taking on a more ellipse. An egg has a different curve at the two ends, right? Okay, if you imagine an egg that has the same curve as the two ends, it's not the exact same. You mean what that is? Literally, the atmospheric porous
There's a series of spacecraft that can turn the orbit around the Earth that get as low as possible in the Earth's atmosphere. That's all that serves as for. And there are a bunch of same scientists on the Pioneer Venus team. There are 117 scientists all together in Pioneer Venus. The biggest number of scientists that have ever had a planetary mission, and that's because this is the biggest number of experiments that have ever been flown on a planetary mission. In that respect, Pioneer Venus is the most important planetary mission that has been flown. The place that I showed you want to get the least press of it. In another respect, it's not. Viking experiments is actually a tremendously, a tremendously more complicated, particularly biology investigation, than anything from Pioneer Venus. But still, we've got the biggest number of experiments on Pioneer Venus that anything has ever been flown. 12 different experiments to observe the atmosphere from actually in it, as well as from farther out, taking pictures of it and through the same spectral observation on the orbiter. Basically, the correct one. And there's a very simple reason why it might. As you go out through the solar system and look at what terrestrial planets are made of one after another, you have 12 of them altogether, some of which are revolving around orbiting planets and moons, but they're still terrestrial planets. And those are Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Moon, Mars, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto revolving around Jupiter, Titan revolving around Saturn, Titan revolving around Neptune and Pluto, okay? And you find there's a systematic progression in what they are made of in that. The difference between a terrestrial planet and a Jovian planet is basically that when a terrestrial planet forms, its gravity was too weak to hold anything that was gas. At that time, at that particular distance from the sun, the terrestrial planets are made only of whatever was solid at that time, at that distance from the sun. And when you get farther out from the sun, there were things that were solid out there, such as water, which would have been gaseous than where the Earth is. All right? The sun was much hotter, apparently, what the planets were forming than it is now, several hundred to several thousand times hotter. It was going through a stage which we know the stars, I think we know, the stars do go through during their very early lifetime, last about 100 million years in the star, and the sun several times to 10 billion years to be a normal star that we have now. And this early stage where it is very much hotter than light than it is. It's an interesting stage, there's a normal one that's in now. It's called the King Harvey phase, named for a star which appears to be doing it right now. It's in the final process of being born at the present time. And there are all several hundred King Harvey stars that are known more than each other all the time. Well, the most spectacular effect of that is that Mercury, although everybody always says it's in around the same day, it looks just like the moon, so it can be the color of crazy. Lots of worlds are solar craters, so we know that that's in the moon, though. The inside of Mercury is radically different from the moon. Almost the entire planet is made of a nickel iron core, which takes up 80% of the volume of Mercury. The whole thing is basically a 3,000-mile ball bearing with a few hundred miles of rock and a shell on the outside, and that's what we see in the picture. Okay, the reason, and see the moon has almost no iron core at all. Earth has an iron core, but you know, much more normal kind of size as it's made of about 30 and a half of the Earth. Well, the reason apparently is quite simple and quite awe-inspiring. The sun was so hot when the planets were forming that 36 million miles away, rock was a gas. Until the very end of the million or so year period that Mercury took to accrete, to fall together. And then apparently, up until that time, only metals were solid. In other words, they had the highest boiling points of all, so even though the rocks were, they were not. And so you had just the metals. And then at the very end of this period, you had some rock managing to accumulate in that stuff. Venus is made of rock, and so is the Earth. But you notice that there is more water on Earth than there is on Venus, and yet still very, very much less than there would be if we had all the water that we really had coming to us. If you look at the relative abundances of the different kinds of atoms that make up the universe, the ones that make up water, hydrogen and oxygen, are something like 3 times as abundant as the ones that make up the atomic rock, which are mostly oxygen and more silver and other things mixing with them, and combined with them. And in the outer solar system, the terrestrial planets are made of mostly frozen water. And further out, you get things like frozen methane, frozen ammonia, and hydrogen. And so those are normal ones.
far as terrestrial planets go, as far as their composition goes, you see? And then in the inner solar system, you have this abnormal situation. Virtually all of the water was lost in space because the sun was no longer in the Deucalion state, and so our water does not outweigh our rock like it would be time, the way that it would go off. All right, so you see, it makes sense that in the whole scenario, the Venus would have less water than the Earth per cubic mile, and Mars would have more, and some of you can believe Mars does have more than cubic miles. It's all right underground, so this is indirect, but there is reason to believe that Mars got more water per capita. Still mostly rock, but more per cubic mile than the Earth is.
So, okay, now, how do you decide between the two theories?
The picture that I gave you is suggested to that it may be true.
Here's how you decide. If Venus has had lots of water in the past and has been losing its settle into the space, then you take advantage of the fact that oxygen comes in two different forms. Oxygen atoms come in two different isotopes, one of which is heavier than the other.
All right?
The heavy one is going to get lost into space less rapidly than the lighter one. The heavier one is oxygen 18, and the lighter one is oxygen 16. So, if Venus is so low in water because it's been losing it, then when you look at the relative abundances of oxygen 18 and oxygen 16 in the Venus atmosphere, with both the planet Venus orbiter and the large probe are supposed to do, you will find that there is more oxygen 18 relatively on Venus than there is on Earth. On the other hand, if Venus has never had very much water to begin with, then if what oxygen you find, what water you find, is going to have the isotope ratio in the same relative amount of water. No, as a matter of fact, it is not a universal law. When you look at the Earth and the Moon and Mars, the isotope ratio is exactly the same. There are meteorites, however, and the only way to change some of the problem is really frustrating. Here are three space rocks being delivered to you by nature. You don't even have to go out there and get them. Oh, you don't know where it came from, you know? I mean, you can track their orbits in some cases before they fell. You don't know what their ultimate origin was. But there are a number of different classes of meteorites which have different oxygen isotope ratios in the Earth, and they differ from others. And that is just some of the evidence. I don't know if you know that there are two classes of kinds of atoms in the universe. Hydrogen and helium, and then everything else. Alright? Hydrogen and helium make up 99% of the atoms in the universe. They were formed when the universe itself was first formed, in the figure 15, 20 billion years ago, something like that, when it's called the Big Bang. And apparently, the temperature and the pressure were so great then that only the two simplest, most stable kinds of atoms could survive. The only hydrogen and helium were formed. The 1% contamination of heavier stuff, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, silicon, all of the things that terrestrial planets are made of, you and I are made of, were created later inside certain special stars, namely the very heaviest stars, which are the only ones. You know, stars shine by the energy they get by converting one element to another. Okay, something called thermonuclear reaction, which keeps the star hot, therefore it keeps it cold. Alright? The sun shines by converting hydrogen to helium, and that doesn't feel good for this exception. But these heavy stars get to the point, after they do hydrogen to helium first, but then they start building heavier elements, starting with helium. And they go helium to carbon, and then carbon to oxygen, and you get silicon in there, and iron, and magnesium, and aluminum, and all of those things. And in fact, in very small quantities, you get elements maybe that are not the major ones, and that's where the rare things like gold and so forth come from. And those very stars that do that would do something at the end of their lives that normal stars such as that sun do not do, and that is they explode. The entire star blows itself apart. That's called supernova. And when it does that, use all these heavy elements that it's made out in the space, where they contaminate the clouds of gas and dust from which younger generations of stars are forming. And by the time the sun formed, and the rest of the solar system, 4.6 billion years ago, that level of contamination from all the generations of supernovae that preceded us had reached about 1%. And that 1% is
from the gravity your planets are made up, because our gravities are 2 weeks old higher than yours. You are made of material. Every atom of which, besides the hydrogen, has gone through a supernova explosion. You are quite literally made of stardust. That is what the dust that made the terrestrial planets is. Alright? There is evidence, and this is just some of it, that there was one last big nearby supernova explosion just before the solar system formed. And you see, if that happened at the very end, just before the solar system formed, you might have gotten a cloud of what that particular star has produced coming in from one side, which might not have mixed with all the rest of the material in the cloud of gas and dust before the solar system elsewhere, so that you actually had different substances forming in different places. Isn't it an incredible coincidence that you had one last big supernova exploding just before the solar system formed? No. We also have, and it's very recent, this was announced last October, the first observational evidence that the shock waves of the gas coming out from the supernova explosion triggered the formation of sulfur in exactly the same way as the shock waves of a supersonic plane going through the atmosphere can trigger the condensation of raindrops out of a unmolested atmosphere. And so, we probably owe not only the atoms that we are made of, but the very existence of the solar system to that last supernova. Of course, that can't be the entire story. I mean, not all stars surely form because they're triggered by supernova explosions. Well, that's third generation star form. But, you know, we're taking an egg problem here. But once you had older stars and you had occasional supernovae, apparently it's a very efficient mechanism for producing the underground rings of the stars. So that was an awfully long answer to a very short question, but as you see, it was an extremely, a centrally important question, and it leads to an awful lot of interesting stuff on it.
Back in the early 60s, late 50s, Cedric Moore was publishing, of course, in his book of aurora scenes by amateurs.
Mm-hmm. He met the action light.
You were just talking of liquid cores. What do they know about Venus's core and magnetic field?
Venus does not have a magnetic field of any significant size. There is a magnetometer on the Pioneer Venus orbiter, and if there is a very small magnetic field or perhaps local fields down on the surface, we'll find them. But there is nothing like the field of the Earth.
Well, does being closer to the sun increase the chances at all that you're going to have a stronger flux?
Oh, I see what you mean. Increase the chances of aurora. Can't get solar particles around on the night side. See? They just hit the day side and go around, or get absorbed. In fact, that's a very interesting thing about the atmosphere of Venus. The solar wind, the thin stream of particles that come out from the sun, never interacts with the atmosphere of the Earth. It is deflected around our planet by the magnetic field of the Earth. And so it never gets in here. On Venus, the solar wind actually hits the upper atmosphere. And one of the major areas of Pioneer Venus orbiter study is what effect does that have on the atmosphere and on the solar wind? There is a sort of pseudo-magnetic field effect. I mean, it's not a magnetic field, but it has the same effect on the solar wind as the magnetic field on the Earth does. And that is, Venus does have an ionosphere, okay? There is a layer of electrically charged atoms in the upper atmosphere. And the reason for that layer is that in the upper atmosphere, X-rays from the sun are able to penetrate. They can't get very far through the gas. Any gas of any thickness at all will stop X-rays of any wavelength. And in fact, in the Earth's surface atmosphere, no X-ray wavelength will go more than 2 inches. So much for Superman is X-ray vision, where we're completely worthless on any planet with an atmosphere. So we can do this in the Krypton in our atmosphere. Anyway, which is very strange in Krypton gas, but I don't know where the expression cryptic came from. That's very funny, because it's actually the same word, except on what comes from it, from the same word in the kidney. The ionosphere has an electric charge, because the atoms, what happens if you get knock electrons off the atoms? So what's left is an electrically charged atoms, all right? And the electric charges of those atoms repel the electric charges of the solar wind. The solar wind gas is also electric charges. Most of the matter in the universe is not made of whole atoms. It is made of atoms that have lost one or more electrons by one process or another. There are two major processes and some minor ones. The major ones are exactly with radiation of the right wavelength, X-rays, ultraviolet, whatever, depends on the material, or you hit it with something, for example, a proton, an electron, whatever. And virtually all of the matter in the universe is made of parts of atoms, not whole ones. We just happen to be, the reason we're in the school that all matter is made of atoms, is a very Earth-chauvinistic way of looking at it. We just happen to be one of the rare local exceptions. The surface of a planet like this is going to be mostly made of full atoms, although if every atom, if every ion in your body was suddenly to acquire a charge again, you die. The chemical process would require ionization also. But that's another whole story.
So the electric field of the ionosphere of Venus repels the solar wind, but not until the solar wind has gotten down almost to the ionosphere itself. It's not a terribly strong process. So you actually have solar wind pouring into the upper atmosphere of Venus, like you see on the day side. On the night side, you're going to have a cavity in the solar wind. And that's not theory. That cavity was flown through by Mariner 10. Mariner 10 had a magnetometer on it. We didn't know if Mercury had a magnetic field. We already knew Venus.
But it made observations of the planetary magnetic field, the solar wind magnetic field, on the way through. And that cavity is there, no question about it.
So you're going to have aurora.
Auroras are caused by charged particles, whatever their origin, being funneled around and hitting the upper atmosphere on the night side and causing the atoms to glow, causing the molecules to glow. So whatever the hatching light is not of auroral origin.
The Soviet astrophysicist Nikolai Kozlov claimed in the early 60s, if I remember correctly, to have made spectroscopic observations of the action light and to have seen auroral lines. He forgot to have been wrong. And certainly his own countrymen sent a spacecraft up there, you know, and did not see any auroral lines in the night sky. They were looking for it very carefully.
Well, just trying to get the difference between the Earth's aurora
the
sun off the North Pole,
announced it
on the radio,
and Boondock. Here. I haven't started as a disc jockey, although a classical one. We don't talk
about
it. AM. AM, I did. Okay. We were educational. Sure. We didn't know that Mercury had a magnetic field. We had every reason to assume that it didn't. All the theory said that it couldn't. And for two reasons. First, it's too small. All the other small bodies didn't have a magnetic field, and that's because you need a molten core. You do not need an iron core for a magnetic field. You can get it from rock, but you need a molten core. The Earth is not a permanent magnet. There isn't a big ball of solid iron down there in the magnet that we've got a bar magnet. It's molten, and you heat a permanent magnet up above the temperature rather than the degree, and it's called the Curie point, that loses its magnetism. You know, so the Earth is an electromagnet. What you need is a molten core so that, again, the atoms are partly ionized, and convection, which moves some of that stuff around semi-systematically. There has to be only a slight tendency for systematic motion. But if you have any amount of charges moving more in one direction than the other, that's going to produce an electric current, and electric current generates a magnet, and that's where you get the rotation of the magnetic field of the Earth, for example. So what do you think? An awful lot, we don't understand the evolution of the magnetic field of the Earth. How does the magnetic split every 100,000 years or so, for example? But, you know, so basically, that guidebook is what we think is the case. Well, to get that, then first of all, you need a planet that is big enough. So your planet's going to need more physically small parts, all right? So they're expecting to be hotter than the inside. And you need a planet that is big enough to have a molten core, and so you go to the moon, it doesn't have a magnetic field, you're not surprised, it's a small body. You have Mars, it doesn't have a magnetic field, you're not surprised, it's a small body. Mercury is also a small body, all right, so you expect for that reason. You also need a location that is rapid enough to excite the motions within the core, a certain velocity of the rotation itself. And Mercury, as Venus rotates very slowly, does not have a magnetic field, even though it's big enough to the Earth, and it's very large, and molten core, we don't know. We probably won't find that out in 5 years because there's a faint chance we might, indirectly by observations of what the interior structure of Venus does to the orbit of the orbiter. But, you know, Venus does rotate slowly because it's very sunny, doesn't have a molten core, and Mercury rotates slowly also. Yeah, but Mercury was just obviously a candidate for a body that you predict. You couldn't have a magnetic field. And there were a lot of people who criticized, including Hadrosaurus on Mariner's head, just for that reason. They said, you know, it's just the weight of the label off, which isn't some other instrument. But they did it anyway, partly to study the interplanetary magnetic field, so it went that close to the sun. Nobody ever gone that close to the sun before. And everybody's astonished Mercury has a magnetic field. It's weak. It's only about 1% as strong as the Earth. But, you know, what the guy said about the talking dog was the market was not just done well, it was done at all. It's just not supposed to be there. It's a kind of weird magnetic field. If you draw the dipole, that is the line from the north magnetic pole to the planet to the south magnetic pole, you expect to go through the center of the planet. Roughly. The Earth doesn't exactly, you know, about that a little bit, but not doing much. And you don't expect to be very much closer to the rotation axis. Mercury's dipole is offset from the planet from the center by an entire half of the radius of the planet. Which means that there are 10 to 1 variations in the strength of the magnetic field of the curve of the Mercury. So there are places where the solar wind is fended off tremendous distances into space by the magnetic field, and there are other places where the magnetic field is so weak, solar wind is so weak, and it goes into the and so it hits the curve of the Mercury even though it has a magnetic field. And people, on that note, we're going to have to end because we have hit our magic time at 9:30. So thank you very much for your interest, and remember, much more of you next time.